showing sisterly affection after last weekend's cry fest, but it's still awkward, and I manage to snag my bracelet on her sweater. "Sorry," I mutter, and she gives me a pained grin. We'll get better at that eventually. I've gotten used to stares, so the fact that they've intensified since yesterday doesn't faze me. When I leave class in the middle of history, it's because I feel my period coming on and not because I have to cry. But when I arrive in the girls' room, someone else is. Muffled sounds come from the last stall before whoever's there gets control of herself. I take care of my business, false alarm, and wash my hands, staring at my tired eyes and surprisingly bouncy hair. No matter how awful the rest of my life is, my hair still manages to look good. I'm about to leave, but hesitate and head for the other end of the restroom. I lean down and see scuffed black combat boots under the last stall door. Janae? No answer. I wrap my knuckles against the door. It's Addie. Do you need anything?
Jesus, Addie, Janae says in a strangled voice. No, go away.
Okay, I say, but I don't. You know, I'm usually the one in that stall bawling my eyes out, so I have a lot of Kleenex if you need some. Also Visine. Janae doesn't say anything. I'm sorry about Simon. I don't suppose it means much given everything you've heard, but I was shocked by what happened. You must miss him a lot. Janae stays silent, and I wonder if I've stuck my foot in my mouth again. I'd always thought Janae was in love with Simon, and he was oblivious. Maybe she'd finally told him the truth before he died and got rejected. That would make this whole thing even worse. I'm about to leave when Janae heaves a deep sigh. The door opens, revealing her blotchy face and black-on-black clothing. I'll take that Visine, she says, wiping at her raccoon eyes. You should take the Kleenex, too, I suggest, pressing both into her hand. She snorts out something like a laugh. How the mighty have fallen, Addie. You've never talked to me before. Did that bother you? I ask, genuinely curious. Janae never struck me as someone who wanted to be a part of our group. Unlike Simon, who was always prowling around the edges, looking for a way in. Janae wets a Kleenex under the sink and dabs at her eyes, glaring at me in the mirror the whole time. Screw you, Addie. Seriously, what kind of question is that? I'm not as offended as I'd normally be. I don't know. A stupid one, I guess. I'm only just realizing I suck at social cues. Janae squirts a stream of Visine into both eyes, and her raccoon circles reappear. I hand her another Kleenex so she can repeat the wiping process. Why? Turns out Jake's the one who was popular, not me. I was riding coattails. Janae takes a step back from the mirror. I never thought I'd hear you say that. I am large. I contain multitudes, I tell her, and her eyes widen. Song of Myself, right? Walt Whitman? I've been reading it since Simon's funeral. I don't understand most of it, but it's comforting in a weird way. Janae keeps dabbing at her eyes. That's what I thought. It was Simon's favorite poem. I think about Ashton and how she's kept me sane over the past couple of weeks, and Cooper, who's defended me at school even though there's no real friendship between us. Do you have anybody to talk to? No, Janae mutters, and her eyes fill again. I know from experience she won't thank me for continuing the conversation. At some point we need to suck it up and get to class. Well, if you want to talk to me, I have a lot of time. And space next to me in the cafeteria. So, open invitation or whatever. Anyway, I really am sorry about Simon. See you. All things considered, I think that went pretty well. She stopped insulting me toward the end, anyway. I return to history, but it's almost over, and after the bell rings, it's time for lunch. My least favorite part of the day. I've told Cooper to stop sitting with me because I can't stand the hard time everyone else gives him, but I hate eating alone. I'm about to skip and go to the library when a hand plucks at my sleeve.
Hey.
It's Bronwyn, looking surprisingly fashionable in a fitted blazer and striped flats. Her hair's down, spilling over her shoulders in glossy dark layers, and I notice with a stab of envy how clear her skin is. No giant pimples for her, I'll bet. I'm not sure I've ever seen Bronwyn looking this good, and I'm so distracted that I almost miss her next words. Do you want to eat lunch with us? I tilt my head at her. I've spent more time with Bronwyn in the past 2 weeks than I have the last 3 years at school, but it hasn't exactly been social.
Really?
Yeah, well, we have some stuff in common now, so...
Bronwyn trails off, her eyes flicking away from mine, and I wonder if she ever thinks I might be the one behind all this.
She must, because I think it about her sometimes, but in an evil genius cartoon villain sort of way. Now that she's standing in front of me, with cute shoes and a tentative smile, it seems impossible.
All right, I say, and follow Bronwyn to a table with her sister, Yumiko Mori, and some tall, sullen-looking girl I don't know. It's better than skipping lunch at the library.
When I get out front after the last bell, there's nothing. No news vans, no reporters. So I text Ashton that she doesn't have to pick me up, and take the opportunity to ride my bike home. I stop at the extra-long red light on Hurley Street, resting my feet on the pavement as I look at the stores in the strip mall to my right. Cheap clothes, cheap jewelry, cheap cellular, and cheap haircuts. Nothing like my usual salon in downtown San Diego, which charges $60 every 6 weeks to keep split ends at bay. My hair feels hot and heavy under my helmet, weighing me down. Before the light changes, I angle my bike off the road and over the sidewalk into the mall parking lot. I lock my bike on the rack outside Supercuts, pull off my helmet, and go inside.
Hi.
The girl behind the register is only a few years older than me, wearing a flimsy black tank top that exposes colorful flower tattoos covering her arms and shoulders.
Are you here for a trim?
A cut.
Okay. We're not super busy, so I can take you right now.
She directs me to a cheap black chair that's losing its stuffing, and we both gaze at my reflection in the mirror as she runs her hands through my hair.
This is so pretty.
I stare at the shining locks in her hands.
It needs to come off.
A couple inches? I shake my head.
All of it.
She laughs nervously.
To your shoulders, maybe?
All of it, I repeat. Her eyes widen in alarm.
Oh, you don't mean that. Your hair is beautiful.
She disappears from behind me and reappears with a supervisor. They stand there, conferring for a few minutes in hushed tones. Half the salon is staring at me. I wonder how many of them saw the San Diego news last night, and how many think I'm just an overly hormonal teenage girl. Sometimes, people think they want a dramatic cut, but they don't really. The supervisor starts cautiously. I don't let her finish. I'm beyond tired of people telling me what I want.
Do you guys do haircuts here, or should I go somewhere else?
She tugs at a lock of her own bleached blonde hair.
I'd hate for you to regret this. If you want a different look, you could try...
Shears lie across the counter in front of me, and I reach for them. Before anyone can stop me, I grab a thick handful of hair and chop the whole thing off above my ear. Gasps run through the salon, and I meet the tattooed girl's shocked eyes in the mirror.
Fix it, I tell her.
So she does.
Chapter 16 Bronwyn, Friday, October 12th, 7:45 p.m. 4 days after we're featured on the local news, the story goes national on Mikhail Powers Investigates. I knew it was coming, since Mikhail's producers had tried to reach my family all week. We never responded, thanks to basic common sense and also Robin's legal advice. Nate didn't either, and Addie said she and Cooper both refused to talk as well. So the show will be airing in 15 minutes without commentary from any of the people actually involved. Unless one of us is lying, which is always a possibility. The local coverage was bad enough. Maybe it was my imagination, but I'm pretty sure Dad winced every time I was referred to as the daughter of prominent Latino business leader Javier Rojas. And he left the room when one station reported his nationality as Chilean instead of Colombian. The whole thing made me wish, for the 100th time since this started, that I'd just taken that D in chemistry. Maeve and I are sprawled on my bed watching the minutes on my alarm clock tick by until my debut as a national disgrace. Or rather, I am. And she's combing through the 4chan links she found through Simon's admin site. "Check this out," she says, angling her laptop toward me. The long discussion thread covers a school shooting that happened last spring a few counties over. A sophomore boy concealed a handgun in his jacket and opened fire in the hallway after the first bell. 7 students and a teacher died before the boy turned the gun on himself. I have to read a few of the comments more than once before I realize the thread isn't condemning the boy, but celebrating him. It's a bunch of sickos cheering on what he did. Maeve, I burrow my head in my arms, not wanting to read anymore. What the hell is this? Some forum Simon was all over a few months back. I raise my head to stare at her. Simon posted there? How do you know? He used that Anarchy SK name from about that, Maeve replies. I scan the thread, but it's too long to pick out individual names. Are you sure it's Simon? Maybe other people use the same name. I've been spot-checking posts, and it's definitely Simon, she says. He references places in Bayview, talks about clubs he was in at school, mentions his car a few times. Simon drove a 1970s Volkswagen Bug that he was freakishly proud of. Maeve leans against the cushions, chewing on her bottom lip. There's a lot to go through, but I'm going to read the whole thing when I have time. I can't think of anything I'd like to do less. Why? The thread's full of weird people with axes to grind, Maeve says. Simon might have made some enemies there. Worth looking into, anyway. She takes her laptop back and adds, I got that encrypted file of Cooper's at the library the other day, but I can't get it open. Yet. Girls? My mother's voice is strained as she calls upstairs. It's time! That's right. My entire family is watching Mikhail Powers Investigates together. Which is a circle of hell even Dante never imagined. Maeve shuts her laptop as I heave myself to my feet. There's a slight buzzing from inside my end table, and I open the drawer to pull out my Nate phone. Enjoy the show, his text says. Not funny, I reply. Put that away, Maeve says with mock severity. Now is not the time. We head downstairs to the living room, where Mom has already settled into an armchair with an exceptionally full glass of wine. Dad's in full evening executive mode, wearing his favorite casual fleece vest and surrounded by a half dozen communication devices. A commercial for paper towels flashes across the television screen as Maeve and I sit side by side on the couch and wait for Mikhail Powers Investigates to start. The show focuses on true crime, and it's pretty sensationalistic, but more credible than similar shows because of Mikhail's hard news background. He spent years as an anchor with one of the major networks and brings a certain gravitas to the proceedings. He always reads the beginning hook in his deep, authoritative voice, while grainy police photos play across the screen. A young mother disappears, a double life exposed, and 1 year later, a shocking arrest. Has justice finally been served? A high-profile couple dead, a dedicated daughter suspected. Could her Facebook account hold the key to the killer's identity? I know the formula, so it shouldn't be any surprise when it's applied to me. A high school student's mysterious death. 4 classmates with secrets to hide. When the police keep running into dead ends, what's next? Dread starts spreading through me. My stomach aches. My lungs compress. Even my mouth has a horrible taste. For almost 2 weeks, I've been questioned and scrutinized, whispered about and judged. I've had to deflect questions about Simon's allegations with police and teachers and watch their eyes harden as they read between the lines. I've waited for another shoe to drop, for the Tumblr to release a video of me accessing Mr. Camino's files, or for the police to file charges. But nothing's felt quite so raw and real as watching my class picture appear over Mikhail Powers' shoulder on national television. There's footage of Mikhail and his team in Bayview, but he does most of his reporting from behind a sleek chrome desk in his Los Angeles studio. He has smooth, dark skin and hair, expressive eyes, and the most perfectly fitted wardrobe I've ever seen. I have no doubt that if he'd managed to catch me alone, I'd have spilled all sorts of things I shouldn't. "But who are the Bayview Four?" Mikhail asks, staring intently into the camera.
"You guys have a name,"
Maeve whispers, but not quietly enough that Mom doesn't hear. "Maeve, there is nothing funny about this," she says tightly as the camera cuts to video of my parents' offices. Oh, no. They're starting with me. "Honor student Bronwyn Rojas comes from a high-achieving family, traumatized by their youngest child's lingering illness. Did the pressure to measure up compel her to cheat and take Yale out of her reach forever?" Followed by a spokesperson from Yale confirming that I have not, in fact, applied yet. We all get our turn. Mikhail examines Addie's beauty pageant past, speaks with baseball analysts about the prevalence of high school juicing and its potential impact on Cooper's career, and digs through the particulars of Nate's drug bust and probation sentence.
"It's not fair," Maeve breathes into my ear. "They're not saying anything about how his dad's a drunk and his mom's dead. Where's the context?"
"He wouldn't want that anyway," I whisper back. I cringe my way through the show until an interview with a lawyer from Until Proven. Since none of our lawyers agreed to talk, Mikhail's team tapped Until Proven as subject matter experts. The lawyer they speak with, Eli Kleinfelter, doesn't look even 10 years older than me. He has wild curly hair, a sparse goatee, and intense dark eyes.
"Here's what I'd say if I were their lawyer," he says, and I lean forward despite myself. "All the attention's on these 4 kids. They're getting dragged through the mud with no evidence tying them to any crime after weeks of investigation. But there was a 5th kid in the room, wasn't there? And he seems like the type who might have had more than 4 enemies. So you tell me, who else had a motive? What story's not being told? That's where I'd be looking."
"Exactly," Maeve says, drawing out each syllable. "And you can't assume Simon was the only person with access to the About That admin panel," Eli continues.
"Anybody could have gotten into that before he died and either viewed or changed those posts."
I look at Maeve, but this time she doesn't say anything, just stares at the screen with a half-smile on her face. I can't stop thinking about Eli's words for the rest of the night, even when I'm on the phone with Nate, half-watching Battle Royale, which is better than a lot of the movies Nate likes. But between Mikhail Powers Investigates and our trip to the mall on Monday, which I've been thinking about nonstop in those spare moments when I'm not thinking about going to jail, I can't concentrate. Too many other thoughts compete for brain space. Nate was about to kiss me, wasn't he? And I wanted him to. So why didn't we? Eli finally said it. Why isn't anyone looking at other suspects? I wonder if Nate and I are officially friend-zoned now. Mikhail Powers does serial investigations, so this will only get worse. Nate and I would be horrible together anyway. Probably. Did People Magazine seriously just email me?
What's going on in that big brain of yours, Bronwyn?
Nate finally asks. Too much, and most of it I probably shouldn't share. I want to talk to Eli Kleinfelter, I say. Not about you, I add when Nate doesn't reply. Just in general. I'm intrigued by how he thinks.
You already have a lawyer. Think she'd want you getting a second opinion?
I know she wouldn't. Robin is all about containment and defense. Don't give anybody anything they can use against you.
I don't want him to represent me or anything. I just want a conversation. Maybe I'll try to call him next week.
You never shut off, do you?
It doesn't sound like a compliment. No, I admit, wondering if I've killed whatever weird attraction Nate might have once felt toward me. Nate's silent as we watch Shogo fake Shuya's and Noriko's deaths.
This isn't bad, he finally says, but you still owe me finishing Ringu in person.
Tiny electrical sparks zip through my bloodstream. Attraction not dead, then? Maybe on life support. I know. That's logistically challenging, though, especially now that we're notorious.
There aren't any news vans here now.
I've thought about this, maybe a few dozen times since he first asked me. And while I don't understand much about what's going on between Nate and me, I do know this. Whatever happens next won't involve me driving to his house in the middle of the night. I start to tell him all my excellent practical reasons, like how the Volvo's noisy engine will wake my parents, when he says,
I could come get you.
I blow out a sigh and stare at the ceiling. I'm no good at navigating these situations, probably because they've only ever happened in my head. I feel weird going to your house at 1 in the morning, Nate. Like it's different from watching a movie. And I don't know you well enough to, not watch a movie with you. Oh, God. This is why people shouldn't wait until their senior year of high school to date. My whole face burns, and as I wait for him to answer, I'm deeply thankful he can't see me.
Bronwyn.
Nate's voice isn't as mocking as I'd expected.
I'm not trying to not watch a movie with you. I mean, sure, if you are into that, I wouldn't say no, believe me. But the main reason I invited you over after midnight is that my house sucks during the day. For one thing, you can see it, which I don't recommend. For another, my dad's around. I'd rather you not, you know, trip over him.
My heart keeps missing beats. I don't care about that.
I do.
Okay. I don't fully understand Nate's rules for managing his world, but for once I'm going to mind my own business and not give my opinion about what does and doesn't matter. We'll figure something else out.
Cooper. Saturday, October 13th, 4:35 p.m. There's no good place to break up with someone. But at least their living room is private, and they don't have to go anywhere afterward. So that's where I give Keeley the news. It's not because of what Nani said. It's been coming for a while. Keely's great in a dozen different ways, but not for me. And I can't drag her through all this knowing that. Keely wants an explanation, and I don't have a good one.
If it's because of the investigation, I don't care, she says tearfully. I'm behind you, no matter what.
It's not that, I tell her. It's not only that, anyway.
And I don't believe a word of that awful tumbler.
I know, Keely. I appreciate that. I really do. There was another post this morning, crowing about the media coverage. The McHale Powers Investigates site has thousands of comments about the Bayview Four. Kind of a dull name, by the way. Would have expected better from a top-ranked news magazine. Some call for jail time. Some rail about how spoiled and entitled kids are today, and how this is another example of that. It's a great story. Four good-looking, high-profile students all being investigated for murder. And nobody's what they seem. The pressure's on now, Bayview Police. Maybe you should be looking a little closer at Simon's old entries. You might find some interesting hints about the Bayview Four. Just saying. That last part made my blood run cold. Simon had never written about me before, but I don't like the implication. Or the sick, heavy feeling that something else is coming. And soon.
Then why are you doing this?
Keely has her head in her hands, tears running down her face. She's a pretty crier, nothing red or splotchy about her. She peers at me with swimming dark eyes.
Did Vanessa say something?
Did what? Vanessa? What would she say?
She's being a bitch about me still talking to Addie, and she was going to tell you something you shouldn't even care about because it happened before we were dating.
She looks at me expectantly, and my blank expression seems to make her mad.
Or maybe you should care, so you'd care about something related to me. You're so holier than thou about how Jake is acting, Cooper, but at least he has emotions. He's not a robot. It's normal to be jealous when the girl you care about is with someone else.
I know. Keely waits a beat before giving a sarcastic little laugh.
That's it, huh? You're not even a little bit curious? You're not worried about me or protective of me? You just don't give a shit.
We're at the point where nothing I say will be right. I'm sorry, Keely.
I hooked up with Nate,
she says abruptly, eyes locked on mine. And I have to admit that surprises me.
At Luis's party the last night of junior year, Simon was following me around all night and I was sick of it. Nate showed up, and I figured, what the hell? He's hot, right? Even if he is a total degenerate.
She smirks at me, a trace of bitterness in her face.
We just kissed. Mostly. That night. Then you asked me out a few weeks later.
She gives me that intense look again, and I'm not sure what she's trying to get across. So you were with me and Nate at the same time?
Would that bother you?
She wants something from me out of this conversation. I wish I could figure it out and let her have it, because I know I haven't been fair to her. Her dark eyes are fastened on mine, her cheeks flushed, her lips slightly parted. She really is beautiful, and if I told her I'd made a mistake, she'd take me back, and I'd keep being the most envied guy at Bayview. I guess I wouldn't like it, I start, but she interrupts me with a half-laugh, half-sob.
Oh my God, Cooper, your face! You seriously could not care less. Well, for the record, I stopped doing anything with Nate as soon as you asked me out.
She's crying again, and I feel like the world's biggest jerk.
You know, Simon would have given anything if I'd chosen him. You didn't even know it was a choice. People always pick you, don't they? They always picked me, too, until you came along and made me feel invisible.
Keely, I never meant... She's not listening to me anymore.
You've never cared, have you? You just wanted the right accessory for scouting season. That's not fair. It's all a big lie, isn't it, Cooper? Me, your fastball. I've never used steroids. I interrupt, suddenly angry. Keeley gives another strangled laugh. Well, at least you're passionate about something. I'm gonna go. I stand abruptly, adrenaline coursing through me as I stalk out her door before I say something I shouldn't. I got tested after Simon's accusations came to light, and I was clean. And I was tested once over the summer as part of an extensive physical the UCSD Sports Medicine Center did before putting together my training regimen. But that's it. And since plenty of steroids disappear from your system within weeks, I can't escape the taint entirely. I've told Coach Ruffalo there's no truth to the accusations, and so far he's sitting tight on contacting any colleges. We're part of the news cycle now, though, so things won't stay quiet for long. And Keeley's right. I've been a lot more worried about that than about our relationship. I owe her a better apology than the one I just half-assed. But I don't know how to give it.
Chapter 17.
Addie. Monday, October 15th, 12:15 p.m. Sexism is alive and well in true crime coverage, because Bronwyn and I aren't nearly as popular with the general public as Cooper and Nate. Especially Nate. All the tween girls posting about us on social media love him. They couldn't care less that he's a convicted drug dealer, because he's got dreamy eyes. Same goes for school. Bronwyn and I are pariahs. Other than her friends, her sister, and Janae, hardly anyone talks to us. They just whisper behind our backs. But Cooper's as golden as ever. And Nate. Well, it's not like Nate was ever popular, exactly. He's never seemed to care what people think, though, and he still doesn't. Seriously, Addie, stop pulling that stuff up. I don't want to see it. Bronwyn rolls her eyes at me. But she doesn't really look mad. I guess we're almost friends now. Or as friendly as you can get when you're not 100% sure the other person isn't framing you for murder. She won't play along with my obsessive need to track our news stories, though. And I don't show her everything. Especially not the horrible commenters tossing racial slurs at her family. That's an extra layer of suck she doesn't need. Instead, I show Janae one of the more positive articles I've found. Look, the most shared article on BuzzFeed is Cooper leaving the gym. Janae looks awful. She's lost more weight since I first ran into her in the bathroom, and she's jumpier than ever. I'm not sure why she eats lunch with us, since most of the time she doesn't say a word, but she glances gamely at my phone. It's a good picture of him, I guess. Kate shoots me a severe look. Would you put that away? I do, but in my head, I'm giving her the finger the whole time. Yumiko's all right, but Kate almost makes me miss Vanessa. No, that's a complete and utter lie. I hate Vanessa. Hate how she's mean-girled her way into the center of my former group, and how she's glommed onto Jake like they're a couple, even though I don't see much interest on his part. Chopping my hair off was like giving up on Jake, since he wouldn't have noticed me 3 years ago without it. But just because I've abandoned hope doesn't mean I've stopped paying attention. After lunch, I head for Earth Science, settling myself on a bench next to a lab partner who barely glances in my direction.
Don't get too comfortable, Ms. Mara warns. We're mixing things up today. You've all been with your partners for a while, so let's rotate.
She gives us complicated directions. Some people move left, others right, and the rest of us stay still. And I don't pay much attention to the process until I wind up next to TJ. His nose looks a lot better, but I doubt it'll ever be straight again. He gives me a sheepish half-smile as he pulls the tray of rocks in front of us closer.
Sorry. This is probably your worst nightmare, right?
Don't flatter yourself, TJ. I think. He's got nothing on my nightmares. All those months of angsty guilt about sleeping with him in his beach house
seem like they happened in another lifetime. It's fine. We classify rocks in silence until TJ says,
I like your hair.
I snort. Yeah, right. With the possible exception of Ashton, who's biased, nobody likes my hair. My mother is appalled. My former friends laughed openly when they saw me the next day. Even Keely smirked. She's moved right on to Luis. Like, if she can't have Cooper, she'll settle for his catcher instead. Luis dumped Olivia for her, but nobody blinked an eye about that.
I'm serious. You can finally see your face. You look like a blonde Emma Watson.
That's false, but nice of him to say, I guess. I hold a rock between my thumb and forefinger and squint at it. What do you think? Igneous or sedimentary? TJ shrugs.
I can't tell the difference.
I take a guess and sort the rock into the igneous pile. TJ, if I can manage to care about rocks, I'm pretty sure you can put in more of an effort. He blinks at me in surprise, then grins.
There you are.
What? Everyone seems absorbed in their rocks, but he lowers his voice anyway.
You were really funny when we... that first time we hung out, on the beach. But whenever I saw you after that, you were so... passive. Always agreeing with whatever Jake said.
I glower at the tray in front of me. That's a rude thing to say. TJ's voice is mild.
Sorry. But I could never figure out why you'd fade into the background that way. You were a lot of fun.
He catches my glare and adds hastily,
not like that. Or, well, yes, like that, but also, you know what? Never mind. I'll stop talking now.
Great idea, I mutter, scooping up a handful of rocks and dumping them in front of him. Sort these, would you? It's not that TJ's fade into the background comment stings. I know it's true. I can't wrap my head around the rest, though. Nobody's ever said I'm funny before. Or fun. I always figured TJ was still talking to me because he wouldn't mind getting me alone again. I never thought he might have actually enjoyed hanging out during the non-physical part of the day. We finished the rest of the class in silence, except to agree or disagree on rock classification. And when the bell rings, I grab my backpack and head for the hall without a backward look. Until the voice behind me stops me like I've slammed into an invisible wall.
Addie.
My shoulders tense as I turn. I haven't tried talking to Jake since he blew me off at his locker, and I'm afraid of what he's going to say to me now.
How have you been?
He asks. I almost laugh.
Oh, you know, not good.
I can't read Jake's expression. He doesn't look mad, but he's not smiling either. He seems different somehow. Older? Not exactly, but... less boyish, maybe. He's been staring right through me for almost 2 weeks, and I don't understand why I'm suddenly visible again.
Things must be getting intense, he says. Cooper's totally clammed up. Do you...
He hesitates, shifting his backpack from one shoulder to the other.
Do you want to talk sometime?
My throat feels like I swallowed something sharp. Do I? Jake waits for an answer, and I mentally shake myself. Of course I do. That's all I've wanted since this happened. Yes.
Okay. Maybe this afternoon. I'll text you.
He holds my gaze, still not smiling, and adds,
God, I can't get used to your hair. You don't even look like yourself.
I'm about to say, I know, when I remember TJ's words.
You were so passive, always agreeing with whatever Jake said.
Well, I am, I say instead, and take off down the hall before he can break eye contact first.
Nate. Monday, October 15th, 3:15 p.m. Bronwyn settles herself on the rock next to me. smoothing her skirt over her knees and looking over the treetops in front of us. "I've never been to Marshall's Peak before," she says. I'm not surprised. Marshall's Peak, which isn't really a peak, more of a rocky outcropping overlooking the woods we cut through on our way out of school, is Bayview's so-called scenic area. It's also a popular spot for drinking, drugs, and hookups, although not at 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. I'm pretty sure Bronwyn has no clue what happens here on weekends. "Hope reality lives up to the hype," I say. She smiles. It beats getting ambushed by Mikhail Powers' crew. We had another sneak-out-the-back routine when they showed up at the front of school today. I'm surprised they haven't wised up to staking out the woods yet. Driving to the mall again seemed like a bad idea, given how high our profile's risen over the past week. So, here we are. Bronwyn's eyes are down, watching a line of ants carry a leaf across the rock next to us. She licks her lips like she's nervous, and I shift a little closer. Most of my time with her is spent on the phone, and I can't tell what she's thinking in person. "I called Eli Kleinfelter," she says. "From Until Proven?" Oh, that's what she's thinking. I shift back. "Okay. It was an interesting conversation," she says. "He was nice about hearing from me, didn't seem surprised at all. He promised he wouldn't tell anybody I'd called him." For all her brains, Bronwyn can be like a little kid sometimes. "What's that worth?" I asked. "He's not your lawyer. He can talk to Mikhail Powers about you if he wants more airtime." "He won't," Bronwyn says calmly, like she's got it all figured out. "Anyway, I didn't tell him anything. We didn't talk about me at all. I just asked him what he thought of the investigation so far." "And?" "Well, he repeated some of what he said on TV. That he was surprised there wasn't more talk about Simon. Eli thought anyone who'd run the kind of app Simon did, for as long as he did, would have made plenty of enemies who'd love to use the four of us as scapegoats. He said he'd check into some of the most damaging stories and the kids they covered. And he'd look into Simon generally, like Maeve's doing with the 4chan stuff." "The best defense is a good offense?" I ask. "Right. He also said our lawyers aren't doing enough to pick apart the theory that nobody else could have poisoned Simon. Mr. Avery, for one." A note of pride creeps into her voice. "Eli said the exact same thing I did. That Mr. Avery had the best opportunity of anyone to plant the phones and doctor the cups. But other than questioning him a few times, the police are mostly leaving him alone." I shrug. "What's his motive?" "Technophobia," Bronwyn says, and glares at me when I laugh. "It's a thing. Anyway, that was just one idea. Eli also mentioned the car accident as a time when everybody was distracted, and someone could have slipped into the room." I frown at her. "We weren't at the window that long. We would have heard the door open." "Would we? Maybe not. His point is, it's possible, and he said something else interesting." Bronwyn picks up a small rock and juggles it meditatively in her hand. "He said he'd look into the car accident, that the timing was suspect."
"Meaning?"
"Well, it goes back to his earlier point that someone could have opened the door while we watched the cars. Someone who knew it was going to happen."
"He thinks the car accident was planned?"
I stare at her, and she avoids my gaze as she heaves the rock over the trees beneath us.
"So you're suggesting somebody engineered a fender bender in the parking lot so they could distract us, slip into detention, and dump peanut oil into Simon's cup? That they couldn't possibly have known he had if they weren't already in the room? then leave Simon's cup lying around because they're stupid.
It's not stupid if they're trying to frame us, Bronwyn points out. But it would be stupid for one of us to leave it there instead of finding a way to get rid of it. Chances were good nobody would have searched us right after.
It still doesn't explain how anybody outside the room would know Simon had a cup of water in the first place.
Well, it's like the Tumblr post said. Simon was always drinking water, wasn't he?
They could have been outside the door watching through the window. That's what Eli says anyway.
Oh, well, if Eli says so.
I'm not sure why this guy's a legal god in Bronwyn's eyes. He can't be more than 25.
Sounds like he's full of dipshit theories.
I'm getting ready for an argument, but Bronwyn doesn't take the bait.
Maybe,
she says, tracing her fingers over the rock between us. But I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I don't think it was anyone in that room, Nate. I really don't. I've gotten to know Addie a little bit this week.
She raises a palm at my skeptical look.
And I'm not saying I'm suddenly an Addie expert or anything, but I honestly can't picture her doing anything to Simon.
What about Cooper? That guy's definitely hiding something.
Cooper's not a killer.
Bronwyn sounds positive, and for some reason that pisses me off.
You know this, how?
Because you guys are so close.
Face it, Bronwyn, none of us really know each other.
Hell, you could have done it. You're smart enough to plan something this messed up and get away with it.
I'm kidding, but Bronwyn goes rigid.
How can you say that?
Her cheeks get red, giving her that flushed look that always unsettles me.
She'll surprise you one day with how pretty she is.
My mother used to say that about Bronwyn.
My mother was wrong, though. There's nothing surprising about it.
Eli said it himself, right?
I say.
Anything's possible.
Maybe you brought me here to shove me down the hill and break my neck.
You brought me here, Bronwyn points out.
Her eyes widen and I laugh.
Oh, come on. You don't actually think...
Bronwyn, we're barely on an incline. Pushing you off this rock isn't much of an evil plan if all you do is twist your ankle.
That's not funny, Bronwyn says.
But a smile twitches at her lips. The afternoon sun's making her glow, putting glints of gold in her dark hair, and for a second, I almost can't breathe.
Jesus, this girl.
I stand and hold out my hand. She gives me a skeptical look, but takes it and lets me pull her to her feet. I put my other hand in the air.
Bronwyn Rojas, I solemnly swear not to murder you today, or at any point in the future.
Deal?
You're ridiculous, she mutters, going even redder.
It concerns me you're avoiding a promise not to murder me.
She rolls her eyes.
Do you say that to all the girls you bring here?
Huh. Maybe she knows Marshall's Peak's reputation after all. I move closer until there's only a couple of inches between us.
You're still not answering my question.
Bronwyn leans forward and brings her lips to my ear. She's so close I can feel her heart beating when she whispers,
I promise not to murder you.
That's hot. I mean it as a joke, but my voice comes out like a growl. And when her lips part, I kiss her before she can laugh. A shock of energy shoots through me as I cup her face in my hands, my fingers grasping her cheeks and the line of her jaw. It must be adrenaline that's making my heart pound so fast. The whole nobody else could possibly understand this bond. Or maybe it's her soft lips and green apple-scented hair, and the way she winds her arms around my neck like she can't stand to let go.
Either way, I keep kissing her as long as she lets me. And when she steps away, I try to pull her back because it wasn't enough.
Nate, my phone,
she says. And for the first time, I notice a persistent, jangly text tone.
It's my sister.
She can wait, I say, tangling a hand in her hair and kissing along her jawline to her neck. She shivers against me and makes a little noise in her throat, which I like.
It's just...
She runs her fingertips across the back of my neck.
She wouldn't keep texting if it weren't important.
Maeve's our excuse. She and Bronwyn are supposed to be at Yumiko's house together, and I reluctantly step back so Bronwyn can reach down and dig her phone out of her backpack. She looks at the screen and draws in a quick, sharp breath.
Oh, God. My mom's trying to reach me, too. Robin says the police want me to come to the station. To, quote, follow up on a couple of things. Unquote.
Probably the same bullshit. I manage to sound calm, even though it's not how I feel.
Did they call you? She asks.
She looks like she hopes they did and hates herself for it. I didn't hear my phone, but pull it out of my pocket to check anyway. No. She nods and starts firing off texts.
Should I have Maeve pick me up here?
Have her meet us at my house. It's halfway between here and the station. As soon as I say it, I kind of regret it. I still don't want Bronwyn anywhere near my house when it's light out. But it's the most convenient option, and we don't have to go inside. Bronwyn bites her lip.
What if reporters are there?
They won't be. They figured out no one's ever around. She still looks worried, so I add, look, we can park at my neighbor's and walk over. If anyone's there, I'll take you someplace else. But trust me, it'll be fine. Bronwyn texts Maeve my address, and we walk to the edge of the woods where I left my bike. I help her with the helmet, and she climbs behind me, wrapping her arms around my waist as I start the engine. I drive slowly down narrow, twisty side roads until we reach my street. My neighbor's rusted Chevrolet sits in her driveway, in the exact same spot it's been for the past 5 years. I park next to it, wait for Bronwyn to dismount, and take her hand as we make our way through the neighbor's yard to mine. As we get closer, I see our house through Bronwyn's eyes, and wish I'd bothered to mow the lawn at some point in the last year. Suddenly, she stops in her tracks and lets out a gasp. But she's not looking at our knee-length grass.
Nate, there's someone at your door.
I stop, too, and scan the street for a news van. There isn't one. Just a beat-up Kia parked in front of our house. Maybe they're getting better at camouflage. Stay here, I tell Bronwyn. But she comes with me as I get closer to my driveway for a better look at whoever's at the door. It's not a reporter. My throat goes dry and my head starts to throb. The woman pressing the bell turns around, and her mouth falls open a little when she sees me. Bronwyn goes still beside me, her hand dropping from mine. I keep walking without her. I'm surprised how normal my voice sounds when I speak. What's up, Mom?
Chapter 18. Bronwyn. Monday, October 15th, 4:10 p.m. Maeve pulls into the driveway seconds after Mrs. McCauley turns around. I stand rigid, my hands clenched at my sides, and my heart pounding, staring at the woman I thought was dead. Bronwyn? Maeve lowers her window and sticks her head out of the car. You ready? Mom and Robin are already there. Dad's trying to get off work, but he's got a board meeting. I had to do some maneuvering about why you weren't answering your phone. You're sick to your stomach, okay? That's accurate, I mutter. Nate's back is to me. His mother is talking, staring at him with ravenous eyes. But I can't hear anything she's saying. Huh? Maeve follows my gaze. Who's that? I'll tell you in the car, I say, tearing my eyes away from Nate. Let's go. I climb into the passenger seat of our Volvo, where the heat is blasting because Maeve's always cold. She backs out of the driveway in her careful, just-got-my-license way, talking the whole time. Mom's doing that whole mom thing, where she's pretending not to be freaked out, but she totally is, she says, and I'm half listening. I guess the police aren't giving much information. We don't even know if anyone else is going to be there. Is Nate coming, do you know? I snap back to attention. No. For once, I'm glad Maeve likes to maintain broiler oven temperatures while driving, because it's keeping the cold inching up my spine at bay. He's not coming. Maeve approaches a stop sign and brakes jerkily, glancing over at me. What's the matter? I close my eyes and lean against the headrest. That was Nate's mother. What was? The woman at the door just now, at Nate's house. It was his mother. But, Maeve trails off, and I can tell by the sound of the blinker that she's about to make a turn and needs to concentrate. When the car straightens again, she says, but she's dead. Apparently not. Maeve sputters for a few seconds. I keep my eyes closed. So, what's the deal? Did he not know she was alive, or did he lie about it? We didn't exactly have time to discuss it, I say. But that's the million-dollar question. I remember hearing 3 years ago through the grapevine that Nate's mother had died in a car accident. We lost my mom's brother the same way, and I felt a lot of empathy for Nate, but I'd never asked him about it back then. I did over the past few weeks, though. Nate didn't like to talk about it. All he said was he hadn't heard anything about his mother since she flaked on taking him to Oregon, until he got news that she'd died. He never mentioned a funeral, or much of anything, really. Well, Maeve's voice is encouraging. Maybe it's some kind of miracle. Like it was all a horrible misunderstanding, and everybody thought she was dead, but really she had amnesia, or was in a coma. Right, I snort. And maybe Nate has an evil twin who's behind it all, because we're living in a telenovela. I think about Nate's face before he walked away from me. He didn't seem shocked or happy. He looked stoic. He reminded me of my father every time Maeve had a relapse, as though an illness he'd been dreading had come back, and he was just going to have to deal with it now. We're here, Maeve says, pulling to a careful stop. I open my eyes. You're in the handicapped space, I tell her. I'm not staying, just dropping you off. Good luck. She reaches over and squeezes my hand. I'm sure it'll be fine. All of it. I walk slowly inside and give my name to the woman behind the glass partition in the lobby, who directs me to a conference room down the hall. When I enter, my mother, Robin, and Detective Mendoza are all already seated at a small round table. My heart sinks at the absence of Addy or Cooper, and at the sight of a laptop in front of Detective Mendoza. Mom gives me a worried look. How's your stomach, honey? Not great, I say truthfully, slipping into a chair beside her and dropping my backpack on the floor. Bronwyn isn't well, Robin says with a cool look toward Detective Mendoza. She's in a sharp navy suit and a long multi-strand necklace. This should be a discussion between you and me, Rick. I can loop Bronwyn and her parents in as needed. Detective Mendoza presses a key on the laptop.
We won't keep you long. Always better to talk face-to-face, in my opinion. Bronwyn, are you aware Simon used to have a companion website for about that, where he'd write longer posts?